Law versus grace. The belief that Torah should no longer be followed often stems from a misunderstanding concerning the nature of the document itself. It is correct to observe that one biblical purpose of the Torah was to prove the sinfulness of men. However, there are more biblical purposes for the Torah than to point out our wrongdoing. In addition, some scholars do not adhere to the basic definition of the Hebrew word Torah as meaning teaching. Instead, they have translated it as law. The Greek word used to translate the Hebrew text in the Septuagint is, indeed, usually rendered law. But this does not mean it should be translated as such in every instance of the biblical text, especially in the Brit Chadashah. Rabbi Eckstein confirms this when he states, "The term Torah has a variety of connotations. Etymologically, it means teachings, not law, as it is so often mistranslated. This translation problem, then, has given rise to a fabricated theological dichotomy in many Christian circles. Oftentimes, this dichotomy is called law versus grace, or a similar formulation. Based on this, some theologians pit Torah against the concept of grace, as if the two are opposed to each other. This problematic theological formulation results in statements such as the following. Quote, "With the coming of Christ, grace as a rule of life superseded law as a rule of life." End of quote. Declarations of this type have gone a long way to influence many believers against Torah. To be sure, if Torah was against grace, then perhaps the above statement would be true. But Torah does not oppose grace. If we adhere to the proper definition of Torah as teaching, as opposed to law, then pronouncements such as the one quoted above are very unfortunate and should be avoided. Let it be stated emphatically, it is man's mishandling, misinterpreting, and misuse of Torah which causes it to be against grace, not the document itself. Idea 2. Only certain parts of Torah should be followed. Some would rather not throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. They are not willing to say that Torah in its entirety should not be followed. Neither, however, are they willing to say that it should. Those who hold to this viewpoint sometimes speak of Torah in terms of a threefold division: civil, ceremonial, and ethical. The civil sections of the Torah are those dealing with governmental functions, such as the teachings concerning capital punishment and other jurisprudent functions. The ceremonial sections concern the sacrifices, the priesthood, and everything connected with these institutions. The ethical laws are those which govern how a person lives his everyday life in relationship to his fellow man. There is a certain degree of merit to this point of view. No matter how we understand certain passages in the book of Hebrews, it is clear that the book singles out at least one separate category of Torah, the ceremonial. In addition, there are also specific parts of the Torah which are applicable only to those who live in the land of Israel. However, when we begin to dissect Torah in a way that was never intended, hermeneutic difficulties inevitably arise. Remember that Torah is a covenant. It is intended to be understood as a whole. For example, is it really fair to the Torah to say that one will only follow the ethical sections while ignoring the civil? More important, does Torah itself give us the right to make such distinctions? The only exception is that made by the Brit Chadashah itself. The sacrifices would no longer be necessary. Idea 3. All of Torah is to be followed, but not necessarily by physical Israel. Some theologians say that all of the Torah should be obeyed, but that the ones who are to do it are the church, which they say has theologically replaced Israel. Of course, in regard to the teachings concerning the sacrifices, they recognize that in Messiah, these came to completion. Nevertheless, they maintain that it is incumbent upon believers to follow the rest of Torah. By suggesting that the church has replaced Israel, adherents to this viewpoint have already revealed their basic method of hermeneutics, spiritualization. They have given up the fundamental, literal interpretation of the Bible in lieu of a symbolic, spiritual, or allegorical one. This viewpoint has characterized most of the church since the middle of the second century and continues to plague a good portion of it, even some of the believing evangelical church, to this very day. To be sure, those who subscribe to this viewpoint are consistent. Just as they transform literal physical Israel into the church, so also do they spiritualize many of the specific teachings of the Torah. For example, we have met a number of people who hold to this viewpoint and have read some of their writings. We have yet to meet one who wears fringes according to Numbers 15. Moreover, we have not met one who faithfully keeps the holy day cycle of Leviticus 23. Somehow, these parts of Torah are spiritualized to mean something else and therefore not followed. We believe that this method of interpretation is not consistent with the proper exegesis of the scriptures. Specifically, Romans 11 makes a clear distinction between non-Jewish believers in Yeshua and physical Israel. It clearly asserts that there is still a future plan for physical Israel. Yes, there are allegories and spiritualization within the Bible, but the use of such figurative language must be governed by recognizing its proper place within the literal, grammatical, historical method of interpretation. Hence, through consistent use of a literal method of scripture interpretation, we can easily lay to rest such theories as the replacement of Israel by the church. Idea 4. Torah is applicable today to Israel and to all so inclined. We now come to our last category. This is the opinion that Torah is to be followed by believers, especially Jewish believers in Yeshua, in this day and age. First and foremost, the remnant. In the foundational chapters of this book, we demonstrated the unique relationship between the Torah and the physical nation of Israel. The Torah is Israel's national constitution, sacred marriage ketubah, and its solemn covenant with God. There is no indication in the scriptures that this special relationship has ended. The establishment of the Brit Chadashah, like the addition of the other covenants, did not abrogate its predecessors. It only affirmed, strengthened, and completed them. This is the thrust of Shaul's argument in Galatians 3, especially when he asks, "Is the Torah then contrary to the promises of God? May it never be." Galatians 3:21. The accusation against Shaul. The Jewish believers of the first century understood this truth as well. Acts 21 recounts a remarkable incident in Shaul's life which illustrates this. Returning from a journey during which he had shared the good news with the Gentiles, Shaul found himself confronted by the Jerusalem leadership. "It was rumored," they said, "that he had been teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moshe, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs." Acts 21, verse 21. Now the leaders wanted to know, were these accusations true or false? Not long before this meeting, Shaul had written to the believers in Galatia and Rome. They were confused by some of the difficult things he had written concerning Torah. Now, face to face with the rabbi, they wanted to know the truth of the matter. Do you follow Torah or not? Do you approve of other Jewish believers following the Torah? In other words, is it still valid to follow the Torah as a Jewish believer in Yeshua? This was Rav Shaul's big moment. Because of his influence as the greatest theologian the body of Messiah ever had next to Yeshua, what he would say or do at this moment was of crucial importance. It would determine the proper interpretation of the confusing statements in his letters concerning Torah. It would also set a precedent for other Jewish believers to follow. So what happened? The elders gave him the option of disproving the allegations by paying for four of them who had taken the Nazirite vow as described in Numbers 6. Not only was he to pay their expenses, but also to go through a purification immersion along with them. Much to the shame of many a modern-day evangelical theologian, he did just as he was asked. Verse 26. What Shaul had done was to make a statement which should have been echoed throughout the centuries. Torah is for today. Jewish believers should be taught and encouraged to follow the Torah of Moshe. Many may not appreciate this conclusion, but the Greek in verse 20 tells us that there were tens of thousands of Messianic Jewish people in Jerusalem, quote, who have believed, and they are all zealous for the Torah, end of quote. 4 centuries later, life was not easy for the early Jewish believers. Because of their trust in Yeshua, they suffered persecution at the hands of traditional Jews. Moreover, because of their adherence to the covenant of Sinai, they would also eventually suffer persecution from other believers in Yeshua. After what is generally referred to as the Second Jewish Revolt, the actual Second Revolt took place in Alexandria, Cyrenaica, and Cyprus, against Rome failed miserably in 135 CE, many church leaders and preachers made a concentrated effort to rid the church of any Jewish trappings. Needless to say, it was the Messianic Jewish observance of Torah that brought the persecution from fellow believers. Not everyone gave in to the pressure, however. There existed from the earliest days a remnant of Jewish believers who were true to the covenant. In church history, this group is called the Nazarenes. When we were taught in Bible college and seminary, very little was taught concerning the Nazarenes. They were portrayed as a group of Jewish believers who, unfortunately, still clung to the law of Moses. A more accurate picture is painted by scholar Dr. Ray Pritz, who wrote his doctoral dissertation on this group. He writes, quote, there emerges from our considerations an entity, a viable entity of law-keeping Christians of Jewish background. These were direct descendants of the first Jewish believers in Jesus. End of quote. Moreover, the Nazarenes did not, quote, accept as binding on themselves or on any Jews the oral law as embodied in the Mishnah. Their Christology, too, called Christ the Son of God. And finally, this group had not lost hope that the Jewish people might yet turn to accept Jesus as the Messiah. End of quote. Both the Nazarenes and their predecessors, the Jewish believers of whom we read in the book of Acts, serve as illustrations that, biblically, Jewish believers in Yeshua have always had a special relationship to the Torah. They were chosen to follow it. The remnant of Torah-observant Jewish believers lasted until sometime near the end of the 4th century, when Torah-keeping Jewish believers in Yeshua somehow left the pages of history. Today, another Jewish revival is taking place. More and more Jewish believers in Yeshua are learning the importance of living according to the national covenant of our people, the Torah. An amended covenant. How much of the Torah can be followed? The book of Hebrews provides part of the answer for us. In Hebrews chapter 8 through chapter 10, we are told that the older covenant has certainly been modified but not done away with. The Brit Chadashah clearly teaches that God does not require us to bring a lamb to our temple. Yeshua is the sacrificial atonement. There are many historical examples of covenants and national constitutions being modified or amended. The first set of amendments to the United States Constitution is called the Bill of Rights. If the Constitution is amended, does that mean that Americans should not follow the old Constitution? Of course not. It is still in force, and citizens of the USA have a special relationship to it which people from other lands do not enjoy. Let us carry this idea over to the Brit Chadashah. The new covenant did not nullify the covenant on Sinai, but simply amended it. In fact, a good linguistic case can be made concerning the Hebrew word for new, chadash. It is the same word that is used for the renewal of the moon every 30 days. This is called a month. In Hebrew, month and new contain the same root, chadash. What happens? Do we get a brand new moon, freshly created every month? No, the appearance of the moon is merely renewed. Carrying this concept over to the word new, the new covenant is not a brand new, freshly drawn agreement. Rather, it is merely a covenant renewal, complete with the appropriate amendments and signs of ratification. Thus, all the regulations concerning the sacrificial priestly system have been amended. Consequently, they are not to be followed. Divine permission. As we begin this difficult discussion, we would like to make two qualifying statements. The first concerns the motivations of the individual in following the Torah. Plainly stated, we believe that no one, Jewish or non-Jewish, may earn, merit, or keep his eternal salvation by following the Torah. The second qualifying statement is that, in this whole discussion of the non-Jewish person's relationship to the Torah, we have purposely avoided the words must and should, as the use of these words tends to cloud the issues at hand, no matter to whom we are referring. Now, how can we engage in a meaningful exploration of this subject without once employing these words? We can begin by examining the implication of a series of biblical passages which directly relate to this subject, that at the very least the relationship of the non-Jewish person to the Torah is one of permission and encouragement. What about all those people? By the grace of God, we received an overwhelmingly favorable response to our first edition of Torah Rediscovered. But this response came from some very unexpected quarters. We anticipated that the book would be read and considered in Messianic Jewish circles. What we could not have predicted was the startlingly positive response from those who cannot be classified as Messianic Jews. We are referring to believers in fellowships, home study groups, and churches which traditionally have not embraced the viewpoints on the Torah espoused by this book. Moreover, we have been impressed at the sheer numbers of people responding to this message. Many evangelicals, charismatic and otherwise, are hungry to know more about the Torah. Beyond that, however, many of these have expressed a deep desire not only to know the Torah, but also to learn to follow it. What should we say to such people? More important, what would the Holy One say to them? To answer this, we need to look into His Word. Following are several passages of Scripture which have one thing in common. All have something to teach us about the relationship of non-Israelites to the Torah of Israel. Even though these passages come from quite diverse locations in the Scriptures, we will strive to avoid violating their context and intended meaning. We submit these teachings for your prayerful consideration. Our Father, Abraham. Abraham was not a Jewish person. He was born a Gentile in the city of Ur of the Chaldeans, a city in Mesopotamia. We are not certain how he came to believe in the one true God, the creator of heaven and earth, the God of his descendants, Israel. But as we read about him in the pages of Genesis, we find a Gentile who has a profound relationship with God. It is true that Abraham was the father of the Jewish people, but he himself was not born Jewish. Judaism began with Abraham when God entered into a covenant, signified by circumcision, with him and his progeny. Abraham lived several hundred years before one of his descendants, Moshe, would receive the Torah at Mount Sinai. Yet the Lord said of him, "Abraham heard my voice and guarded my commandments, my statutes, and my Torah." Genesis 26, verse 5. Actually, the Hebrew is even more emphatic. "Abraham heard my voice and guarded my protective guards, my commandments, my statutes, and my Torah." How did Abraham do this before the Torah, the mitzvot, and the chukim were revealed to Moshe? How did he come to call upon the name of the Lord? How did he know, as his ancestor Noah, knew, that to relate properly to the Lord required a blood sacrifice? Could it be that the Lord himself somehow revealed to these non-Jewish men of God portions of his holy Torah in the expectation that they would receive his teaching as his word to them? Israel was to attract the Gentiles. Let us travel onward in history to the time when Abraham's physical family, the children of Israel, were camping on the plains of the Jordan Valley opposite Jericho and preparing to take possession of the promised land. The Lord had called this nation to be separate and holy unto him. They were to live the Torah before the surrounding nations as a mighty witness of the true God, who he was, and how he desired his people to relate to him. God equipped Israel for this task in many ways. For example, he chose to situate the nation at the crossroads of the world. The Promised Land was an ancient and natural land bridge between Japan, India, China in the Far East, Africa in the South, and Europe in the North. Accordingly, many of antiquity's most traveled trade routes traversed the land of Israel. Because of this, the Israelites had ample exposure to people from all nations of the then known world. Furthermore, the Holy One provided Israel with the Torah. This body of writing contained provisions and instructions for relating properly to God, living peacefully with others, and finding prosperity in the land. If Israel had made the Torah their national lifestyle in the way God intended, all nations of the earth would have discovered this life and flocked to Israel's God, the one true God. As we read in the Torah itself, "See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near to them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today?'" Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 through 8. Suppose for a moment that it had worked. Suppose that some Gentile people groups had observed the wisdom of Israel's God as expressed through the living out of the Torah, and that, provoked to jealousy, they had chosen to embrace the God of Israel. What then? Would Israel have said to these non-Jews, "You can have our God, but not our Torah"? That would be ludicrous. The text in Genesis clearly implies that to accept Israel's God also meant to live by the revealed wisdom of his Torah. The prophets made provision for Gentiles. Let us continue again through the centuries to approximately 700 BCE. When Isaiah, one of Israel's greatest prophets, wrote his book, he did so with the intention of admonishing Israel and Judah to forsake their sins and to live by the covenant of the Torah. He also encouraged the faithful remnant of believers to continue in their faith in the Lord. However, Isaiah had a message for the Gentiles as well. He had words of rebuke and warning for them, as chapters 13 through 23 indicate. However, particularly in chapter 56, we also find words of encouragement for the remnant of Gentiles who followed the God of Israel. Indeed, for our purposes, this is a most remarkable passage, meriting our close attention. Chapter 56 of Isaiah opens up with an encouragement to the remnant of Israel to continue following the covenant of Torah. The prophet calls upon them to maintain justice and do what is right, as well as to keep the Shabbat. These are the words which we might expect the prophet of Israel or Judah to speak to the Jewish people. Notice, however, who Isaiah is addressing in verses 3 and 6. He speaks about the foreigner, but not just any foreigner. These are foreigners who have bound themselves to the Lord. In other words, the prophet has some important things to say to the non-Jewish believers. First, Isaiah tells these non-Israelites, non-Jewish believers, that the Lord himself will make certain to include them with the remnant of his people among Israel. This is the thrust of chapter 56, verse 3. Second, presumably because these Gentile believers share a portion with Israel, Isaiah reminds them that the Lord will grant them access to my holy mountain, and that he will accept their offerings at the temple, because my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations. In the Hebrew, the word translated nations is Amim, literally peoples. In other words, God was doing all he could to assure these non-Israelite believers that they were on equal footing with Israel, the people of the covenant. Yet he refers to them not as Israel, but as foreigners. Third, notice how Isaiah describes the lifestyle of these Gentile believers. He characterizes them in verse 6 as people, quote, who keep the Shabbat without desecrating it, and who hold fast to my covenant, end of quote. This is an utterly remarkable statement to make about believers not born physically into the nation of Israel. It implies that although they cannot be called Jews because of their birth, yet because of their relationship with the Lord, they are entitled to follow Torah, and even encouraged in their observance. In addition, they are described as participants in the covenant. Finally, in verse 8, Isaiah prophesies about the generations to come. He looks beyond his present situation and says, "The sovereign Lord declares, he who gathers the exiles of Israel, I will gather still others to them besides those already gathered." At the very least, the Lord was promising that many from among the nations would believe in him, thereby becoming a part of them, Israel, which would include living by the Torah. When would this happen? The natural answer to this would be at the ingathering of the Gentiles described in the book of Acts.